Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Stuttered Kennedy. Chapter 32. Tremont Temple. But whether it was an attack on her doctrine by ministers of religion and others who differed from her, or an attack on her claim to be the true discoverer of that doctrine, as seen in the onslaughts of Julius Dresser and others, the only effect upon Mrs. Eddy and the progress of the movement she was fostering was to aid them. The effect of the Julius Dresser controversy was to stimulate public interest. Mrs. Eddy and her teaching were rapidly becoming the most talked-of subject in Boston, and a situation arose which required all the woman's determination to offset. It became fashionable to know her, and still more fashionable to invite her to be present at various social gatherings. Whenever there was a prospect that by so doing she could promulgate her teaching, Mrs. Eddy was glad and even eager to accept. But when there was no such prospect, and the motive for the invitation was curiosity or social prestige, she was vigorous and often curt in her refusals. It was, however, at just such gatherings that she found many of those destined later to become prominent in the movement. The years of 1883 to 1885 were particularly notable in this respect. Julia Bartlett has already been mentioned. Another important figure was that of Ira O. Knapp, who later took a prominent part in the founding of the Mother Church and was one of its directors. His long white patriarchal beard and kindly ways made him for years one of the most picturesque figures in the movement. Like many others, he was definitely attached to Christian Science through a remarkable healing, that of his wife, who, after years of helpless invalidism, as a result of which she had lost the use of her limbs, was restored suddenly and completely to health. Ira O. Knapp came of sturdy New England stock. Like Mrs. Eddy, he was born in the hills of New Hampshire on June 7, 1839, having first seen the light in the little town of Lyman, not far from the great bend of the Connecticut River at 15 Miles Falls. He could trace his ancestry through his father's line to one Aaron Knapp, who settled in Taunton, Massachusetts in 1639, about the time when the Son of Thunder, Thomas Hooker, and his followers were planting the three towns of Hartford, Windsor, and Wethersfield, in the land which was afterwards to be called Connecticut. A later ancestor, Abiel Knapp, was a soldier in the Revolutionary War and was the first of his family to live in New Hampshire. Ira attended the district school of his town and the academies of Newbury and Peacham, Vermont. Afterwards, he farmed and taught school. He also, as time went on, held such local offices as school superintendent and selectman of his town and justice of the peace of his county. He took his wife, Miss Flavia S. Stickney, from among his own people in Lyman. That was in 1866, and some 18 years later, this same Flavia, through her infirmities, brought Ira and herself into Christian Science, and so changed the course of their lives. Another figure was Joseph S. Eastman, a retired sea captain of the old school, later one of the directors of the Mother Church. Replete with high adventure, shipwrecks, and strange wanderings in India, China, Peru, he too was brought to Christian Science through the healing of his wife. He had, it seems, been to Hawthorne Hall several times, and at last applied directly to Mrs. Eddy for help. Not a little to his amazement, Mrs. Eddy, instead of offering to help his wife, surprised him by asking why he did not heal his wife himself. She then appears to have explained to him that if he would enter one of her classes, he could learn how this might be done. Not a little incredulous, he agreed, with the result that within a few days, with the assurance of a man who all his life had been used to doing things, he began using what little he knew in the direction indicated, apparently with excellent result. As he puts it in his own record of the matter, "As I understood the rudiments, I began to treat her, and so quickly did she respond to the treatment that she was able to avail herself of the kindly invitation of the teacher to accompany me to the final session." But perhaps the most notable adherence to the cause about this time, notable because of the strange part they were later destined to play in the history of the movement, were Josephine Woodbury and Augusta Stetson. Of these, Josephine Woodbury had known and admired Mrs. Eddy since 1879, when she and her husband, Edgar Frank Woodbury, had become interested through reading Science and Health. They were socially prominent people, with a townhouse in Boston and a summer place in Maine. Mr. Woodbury had helped Mrs. Eddy in the formation of the Metaphysical College and had been one of its directors. In 1884, after several years of hesitancy, Josephine Woodbury decided definitely to cast in her lot with the new movement. She was an eloquent speaker, with a good voice, and an unusually attractive presence. She was also something of a poet and a writer, and she had all the defects of her virtues. In these early days, she carried all before her. Then there was Augusta Stetson. When she first met Mrs. Eddy in 1884, she was a woman a little over 40, who, after a period of study at the Boston School of Oratory, was just setting out on a career as an elocutionist. She was a striking woman, tall and generous in build, with a singularly compelling presence. She was not beautiful like Josephine Woodbury, but she had a way of commanding attention which was the subject of comment all her life. As a little girl in Damariscotta, Maine, where her father, Peabody Simmons, was engaged as an architect, she was devoted to music, and when she was only 14, played the organ in church. She married at 22, Captain Frederick Stetson, a veteran of the Civil War, who was associated with his father in the work of shipbuilding. And shortly afterward, the two went out to India in connection with the shipbuilding business, living for several years in Bombay, and then later on in Okyab, British Burma. In the early 80s, Captain Stetson's health, he had never recovered from privations suffered in the notorious Libby prison during the Civil War, broke down completely, and the two returned to America, where Augusta determined to make a living for them both. So it was when Mrs. Eddy met her in the spring of 1884. She had been invited to attend a lecture given by Mrs. Eddy in a private house in Charlestown. When the lecture was over, the two met, and Mrs. Eddy seems to have recognized at once some exceptional ability in Augusta Stetson. She asked her to come and see her, assuring her, as she often did to a promising newcomer, that if she would study Christian Science, she could do a great work in it. Mrs. Stetson did not respond at once, but she evidently maintained her interest in Christian Science, for in the fall of 1884, she invited Mrs. Eddy to give a lecture in her house, as the result of which she decided to join the next class, which at that time was enrolling. Augusta Stetson appears to have made the decision after much hesitation, even wondering whether she could spare the time from her work as an elocutionist, which just then was becoming more or less established. However, she decided to join, and within 3 weeks, all else was forgotten. She came out of the class with only one thought: to devote herself completely to the practice of Christian Science. All thoughts of any other work were entirely put aside, and it was not long before her remarkable success as a healer began to be widely known. But Augusta Stetson was not the only one who had amazing success about this time. Indeed, it would be impossible to explain the remarkable progress of the new teaching in any other way save on the basis of the spectacular exhibition of healing, which seems to have been in evidence in many quarters. It is possible that a great deal of it was simply faith healing, intensified enormously, as in every case of religious revival, by the cumulative enthusiasm of increasing numbers. Many years later, Edward Kimball, one of the ablest exponents of Christian Science, was to admit frankly that a great deal of the healing in Christian Science, especially in these early days, was faith healing. But whether through faith or through understanding, there can be no doubt cast on the cures, which from now on are to be recorded in increasing numbers. From its first issue, Cases of healing were given periodically in the Christian Science Journal. But it was not until about 1884 or 1885 that the records of cures became a regular feature. Up to then, practitioners in various parts of the country had sent in accounts of the cases they had handled, and some of these had been published. Later on, it became the practice to have the original testimonials from the people themselves who had actually been healed. One of Augusta Stetson's records, as found in Volume 3 of the Christian Science Journal, is certainly a remarkable statement. Writing from Somerville, Massachusetts, she enumerates 9 or 10 cases of healing. Among them, a hopeless case of cancer, a case of diphtheria, chronic heart disease, and a badly sprained ankle which had failed to yield to medical treatment for some weeks. She gives her address and simply states that she will be glad to give full details of these cases to anyone who is interested. The record of Julia Bartlett is no less remarkable. Early in 1884, a young girl from Sugar Hill, New Hampshire, whose case had been pronounced hopeless by her local doctor, applied to Miss Bartlett for help. She was healed in 9 days, and on returning to Sugar Hill, her remarkable recovery attracted so much attention that Miss Bartlett received an earnest appeal to visit the little mountain town. She decided to go, and during the 11 days she spent there, she is credited with having as many as 70 patients a day, many of whom were cured instantaneously. When the widest margin is left for possible, if unintentional, exaggeration, the fact still remains that only by some extraordinary phenomena, as are here indicated, can the tremendous impulse given to the movement about this time be explained. Especially in the early days, it was the healing work, almost alone, that attracted public attention, and, as has been seen, attracted it to a remarkable extent. Mrs. Eddy herself had a considerable reputation for healing work, but from the first, she seems to have felt that her great mission was as a teacher, and that through her teaching, the demonstration of her science could be made more universal by the ever-widening practice of her students. As a teacher, she had, in a marked degree, an ability, shared in a measure by all great teachers, of arresting attention even before she began to speak. The first session of a class was in the nature of a revelation to those attending it. Thus, a Miss Lulu Blackman, who traveled about this time, 1885, from Lincoln, Nebraska, to go through one of Mrs. Eddy's classes, remarks in her account of the matter upon this fact. When she entered the classroom, I saw her for the first time. Intuitively, the members of the class rose at her entrance and remained standing until she was seated. She made her way to a slightly raised platform, turned and faced us. She stood before us, seemingly slight, graceful of carriage, and exquisitely beautiful even to critical eyes. She was every inch the teacher. On the larger platform of the lecture hall, she seems to have been even more arresting. She had a remarkable poise and lack of all self-consciousness, and had at times a happy and quiet humor which tended to modify, if not silence, dissent. Word of her preaching had by this time traveled far. Hawthorne Hall had been outgrown, and the church now held its services in the much larger Chickering Hall. And then, one day, Mrs. Eddy appeared on the platform of Tremont Temple. Tremont Temple was in those days, as indeed it still is, the scene of many notable gatherings and a platform for many notable people. In 1885, it was occupied every Monday by the Reverend Joseph Cook, a popular lecturer of his day. And the Monday lecture in Tremont Temple was one of Boston's favorite and fashionable occasions. It happened at a lecture of his early in March 1885 that Mr. Cook read a letter from one of Mrs. Eddy's most bitter opponents, the Reverend A.J. Gordon, denouncing Christian Science and all its works with a thoroughness which was characteristic of those early days. Mrs. Eddy immediately demanded the right to reply to these denunciations and charges from the same platform. Mr. Cook agreed that she should have 10 minutes on the following Monday, March 16th. And so, at the time appointed, Mrs. Eddy appeared on the platform, and in exactly 10 minutes gave an exposition of her teaching which created much stir at the time and has since become historic. Recognizing, with what must be regarded as rare skill, that it would be impossible to present even the most general synopsis of her doctrine in a time so short, she confined herself to questions and answers, asking the questions she knew her audience was eager to ask, and answering them clearly and crisply and without evasion. The one, evidently, most asked, she put first. Am I a spiritualist? Her answer was direct and emphatic enough. I am not and never was. And then she went on to explain how she understood the impossibility of intercommunion between the so-called dead and living. How her life had always been attended by phenomena of an uncommon order, which spiritualists miscalled mediumship. But how she clearly understood that no human agencies were employed, but that the divine mind reveals itself to humanity through spiritual law. And then she continued, to such as are waiting for the adoption, to wit, the redemption of our body, Christian Science reveals the infinitude of divinity and the way of man's salvation from sickness and death. Her next question brought another vital issue into the open. Christian Science had been described by more than one minister in Boston as a godless faith, in which a kind of esoteric transcendentalism was substituted for true Christian doctrine. And so she asked the question, "Do I believe in a personal God?" Her answer seems to have stood out as one of the great confessions of faith. "I believe in God," she said, "as the supreme being. I know not what the person of omnipotence and omnipresence is, or what the infinite includes. Therefore, I worship that of which I can conceive, first as a loving father and mother. Then, as thought ascends the scale of being to diviner consciousness, God becomes to me, as to the apostle who declared it, God is love, divine principle, which I worship, and after the manner of my fathers, so worship I God." She took each question slowly and deliberately, and as quickly became apparent, as question and answer followed each other, that she was working on a well-conceived plan. For having dismissed spiritualism and affirmed her faith in the fatherhood and motherhood of God, her next point was clearly the relationship of God to man, and so she asked, "Do I believe in the atonement of Christ?" She paused a moment, and then said simply, "I do." "And this atonement," she continued, "becomes more to me, since it includes man's redemption from sickness as well as from sin. I reverence and adore Christ as never before." Another pause, and then this question, "How is the healing done in Christian Science?" Here was the crux of the whole matter. The Tremont Temple was filled to overflowing. Many were standing at the back of the great gallery which circles the hall, and it is not difficult to imagine the wave of expectancy which swept over the audience. It was a question everyone was asking. How was the healing done? Her answer was certainly remarkable for its succinctness. "This answer," she added, "includes too much to give you any conclusive idea in a brief explanation. I can name some means by which it is not done. It is not one mind acting upon another mind. It is not the transference of human images of thought to other minds. It is not supported by the evidence before the personal senses. Science contradicts this evidence. It is not of the flesh, but of the spirit. It is Christ come to destroy the power of the flesh. It is truth over error that, understood, gives man ability to rise above the evidence of the senses, take hold of the eternal energies of truth, and destroy mortal discord with immortal harmony, the grand verities of being." Christian Science is not a remedy of faith alone, but combines faith with understanding, through which we may touch the hem of his garment and know that omnipotence has all power. "I am the Lord, and there is none else. There is no God beside me." Time was running short now, but she had measured it well. There was one more question. Is there a personal man? The scriptures were clear enough, she said. Man was made in the image and likeness of God. She commended the Icelandic translation of the passage in Genesis. He created man in the image and likeness of mind. In the image and likeness of mind created he him. This image and likeness of mind did not yet appear, but it would appear more and more as the perfect model was held in mind. And man's contemplation regarding himself turned resolutely away from inharmony, sickness, and sin to that which is the image of his Maker.